Okay, so let's start with our motivation. So typically in our day, our thoughts are going along the line of what makes me comfortable, how can I feel safe, what meets with my approval, what looks like it's going to harm me. And so our thoughts are always fluttering around the I, the self, thinking it's the most important thing. And this kind of self-emphasis, my needs, my feelings, my aspirations, my Dharma practice, it kind of becomes quite draining after a while. And I think it's very helpful to shift the way we see things and think about what kind of person do I want to become? Not what so much, what do I need now to feel comfortable, but what kind of person do I want to become in the future? So maybe we want to become someone who isn't affected by other people's criticism. Or maybe we want to become someone who doesn't compare themselves with others. Or maybe we want to become someone who takes joy in everything instead of seeing everything as a task to get done. So I think it's quite helpful to spend some time thinking about what kind of person do we want to be? And then what practices do I need to do to train my mind to be that kind of person? How do I get myself from point A to point B with the help of my spiritual mentors and my Dharma friends? And I think, you know, that take on our lives can really shift things a lot. Then we feel more inspired, more eager. Maybe we're not so concerned with what we think and feel and all of our rules of the universe. And so one of the chief things as Dharma practitioners in the Mahayana tradition that we should want to develop is this altruistic intention of bodhicitta and really have special like regard and admiration for that attitude and keen interest in training our mind to have spontaneous bodhicitta, to become a bodhisattva. Knowing that, you know, that's the best kind of person we can become. It'll lead us to Buddhahood, that's really the best, but bodhicitta will take us there. And so then as we go through our days, you know, to see everything in terms of a practice to help us transform our mind into a bodhisattva's mind. So that we view all of our activities, all of our interactions from that perspective. And so I recommend trying that and see how it feels, how it is different from the current perspective of my comfort, my safety, my needs. And see which perspective actually makes you feel more invigorated. And helps you to make your life meaningful. So now we're going to use learning how to make syllogisms as a way of helping us to make our minds beautiful, our lives meaningful, and our minds beautiful. And to do it with that curiosity and creativity and enthusiasm of a bodhisattva. So I've gotten various emails with all sorts of different syllogisms that people have been practicing making over this. So there's a few of them. I thought maybe we would continue where we left off last week with Venerable Sumten's syllogism. You know, which we realized that, I'll read the two that we started with, that we realized kind of they don't fit the qualities of a valid syllogism. Okay, so we started off with, students continue to die in school shootings because American gun laws don't adequately restrict access to guns. Sounds like a perfectly reasonable syllogism, doesn't it? Until we start to analyze. And then the second one was, people experience profound levels of grief because their loved ones have died due to gun violence. Also, all of us would accept that as a true statement, but is it a syllogism, you know? So anybody want to offer what they've come up with?
I tried to reframe the first one, which I found quite difficult to, but I had American gun laws are a contributing cause of school shootings because they enable easy access to guns.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is that in one of the sheets you sent me?
No.
Okay. So here's Julius unhappy with the winter days. Okay, so say it slowly.
American gun laws are a contributing cause of school shootings because they enable easy access to guns.
Okay, so the subject?
American gun laws.
The predicate? Are a contributing cause. And the reason? To school shootings.
Because they enable easy access to guns is the reason.
Okay. Because they enable easy. So the property... I would agree. Yeah. I wonder if NRA would agree. They want easy access to guns. Yeah, so they would. They might agree with that. Then the pervasion. If it enables easy access to guns, then it necessarily is a contributing cause to school shootings. Okay. Now, I think we would all agree with that. Now, why wouldn't an NRA person agree with that, besides the fact that they're stupid and every other thing that we call them to justify that we're right? But let's try and think reasonably. Why would they want teachers to be armed? Yeah. So they have different views. The syllogism makes good sense to us. What was the pervasion again? If
there is easy access to guns, that's necessarily a contributing cause of school shootings.
Yeah. Now, they would say no. Yeah. The problem is with mentally ill people. It's not what the problem isn't what the pervade, you know. the number of guns. Of course, you know, we look at it and say, well, if you don't have guns, then you can't have school shootings. Yeah, you could have lots of crazy people, but without guns, you couldn't have school shootings. Yeah, you could have guns, and even if there were no crazy people, you could still have school shootings.
So can we say, consider the subject school shootings if there are no guns? There are no shootings if there are no guns? Does that work?
I don't think you can use a lot of ifs there. The thing with the syllogisms is we have to look at something that is verifiable. Yeah? Now, maybe some of our ways of looking are verifiable. Yeah? I mean, certainly if there's no guns, you can't have school shootings. Yes? But then, yeah, that would be verifiable. But then they would say, yes, that's true. But we have our Second Amendment. Right. To which I would say, repeal the Second Amendment. But that's not going to go over big with them.
You put that latter thought into a syllogism. The subject, a gunless society, has no school shootings because there are no guns.
Say it again.
The subject, a gunless society,
Gunless society, yeah.
The subject, a society without guns. Is a society without school shootings,
yeah.
Because there are no guns.
Yeah, right. A society without guns is a society without school shootings because there are no guns. Sounds okay to me. The subject and the reason can be quite similar. It's the predicate and the reason that can't be the same. Yeah. Okay, I came up with one. Where was it? Okay, in American schools, students die in school shootings because assault weapons are easily available. Subject, American schools. Predicate, students die in school shootings. Reason, because assault weapons are easily available. So the property holds, because in American schools, assault weapons are easily available. And if assault weapons are easily available, students die in school shootings. Yeah. Now, we would agree. The NRA would say, no. You can have, just because you have assault weapons doesn't mean people have to die in school shootings.
Is it accurate that in American schools, assault weapons are easily available?
Are easy to bring into American schools.
Yeah.
Are easy to bring in. Yeah. Okay. Oh, people experience profound grief. Okay. So how did you redo that?
Well, for me, people experience profound levels, experience profound levels of grief, the predicate, reason, because their loved ones have died due to gun violence, the reason is not established. But if we put some people experience profound levels of grief because their loved ones have died due to gun violence, I think it works.
Okay, some people, yeah, their loved ones have died in gun violence, okay. And if your loved ones die in gun violence, you experience profound grief.
The question is, do you necessarily experience?
Yeah. Do you necessarily? Yeah. I would say most people do. Yeah. So that one seems, okay.
Just saying some people, it might be a little vague for the form we're using.
Yes.
I have changed it to people who have had their loved ones die due to gun violence.
Yes.
As the subject.
Right.
But even then, some of them might not experience grief because Some of them might not even find out that their loved ones died before they themselves die. Also, I went to the thought of when the Buddha died, and some of the disciples were pulling their hair out and just mourning, and the arhat said, well, didn't he tell you that everything that's compounded disintegrates? And so there was two points of view there about who was in profound grief. But then the sentence, the whole statement kind of holds up in some ways too. It's not maybe that syllogisms always work as a form for what we're trying to express in society. Many people do experience profound grief because of that, even though you can't put that into a syllogism form.
Yeah.
The statement has a lot of truth.
Yeah. So what we're getting at is many things can have truth, but maybe you can't really make them into a syllogism to prove them without any loopholes or ifs, ands, and buts. Yeah. But what a syllogism is trying to do when you're using it to investigate the nature of reality, it's not like, you know, well, things are probably empty because da-da-da-da-da, or, you know, things are a little bit empty, or, you know, there is some emptiness too. Yeah. So what we want are statements that, you know, can be traced back to common experience that people have without a lot of, you know, qualifiers of some and many. And, you know, also when I was looking through a lot of these syllogisms, we put the word should in. Yeah. Should doesn't belong in a syllogism. Yeah. Because should, I mean, syllogisms are looking at, you know, do these things have a causal relationship? Do they have a relationship of one nature? Because those are things that we can test and ascertain. It's not like, you know, what people should do in the future or something. Yeah, because what's that going to prove? We have to deal with how things are and how cause and effect works.
There's also the aspect of the listener. The aspect of the listener, as we talked about last week.
Yeah.
You're putting together a causation that the listener is getting some new knowledge out of, and they agree with the predicate. And they may actually agree with the reason, but they haven't put those together in their own mind.
They may agree with the property. They may agree with the pervasion, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. But they haven't put it together.
Right.
Yeah.
Making conditionals depends on who your listener is. If you're certain listeners, you won't have to put conditionals into the statement.
Yeah, I think putting if in a syllogism is going to be kind of dangerous.
Sorry, that's what I'm saying. If you have the appropriate listener, then you don't need any of the conditionals.
Put it this way: if you have if, then you're not going to have an appropriate listener. Yeah,
I found it helpful in the end of this chapter where he had the exercises, the last exercise, I really found helpful because he talked about it's very difficult in syllogisms to use like qualities of things. You have to use more categories.
Yeah.
And that, I think, really drew me back to the thing of the circles we make, the things that are in the circles and the similar class and dissimilar class.
Yeah.
So I was like, the one I sent you, for example, I realized this is nebulous is the ones we're doing.
Yeah.
And so then that was kind of a bummer. But then I just realized there's got to be a way to take the topics that we're addressing here and get at least elements of them to work, you know, like maybe the one I sent you, I was thinking about later, maybe if I really understood wisdom and the different kinds of wisdom or something like that, I could make syllogisms about categories, you know, of people that had exhibited qualities, but they would fall into categories somehow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, let me read you the one she wrote, and then you can see what you think of it, okay? So it starts out with a quote from Ajahn Buddhadasa, okay? And he said, "What is really needed is a close bond of friendship between disciple and teacher, which allows the teacher to use harsh language while teaching, if need be, and to demand from the disciple anything he wishes in the way of practice. At a higher level, this close bond should be one of affection based on reason, insight, and compassion. Teacher and disciple should not, however, be too much attached to each other. They should not lack confidence in each other. Otherwise, troubles may arise, which will be detrimental to the practice in general." So then she wrote the syllogism. The subject, a person aspiring to be a qualified disciple of the Buddha Dharma, yeah, is accepting of demands from the spiritual mentor in terms of spiritual practice, because he or she is striving to be open-minded, intelligent, and diligent in the long rim of a good disciple. Yeah. Okay. So then you have the subject, a person aspiring to be a qualified disciple of the Buddha Dharma. Okay. Okay. Is striving to be open-minded, intelligent, and diligent. Is that true?
There's that should thing.
You bet. There's that should thing. Yeah, they should be. But does that make somebody who's aspiring to be a qualified disciple of the Buddha Dharma? You know, but it may, let's look a little bit closer. Lots of people think they're a person aspiring to be a qualified disciple of the Buddha Dharma. Tarpa is accepting of demands from the spiritual teacher in terms of spiritual practice. Yeah, because she is striving to be open-minded, intelligent, and diligent. Okay, so if we just said, is Tarpa striving to be open-minded, intelligent, and diligent? That's a should and a sometimes and a when I feel like it and when I'm in a good mood.
But if you just say, Tarpa is striving to become open-minded, intelligent, diligent. Striving is a very specific.
Yeah, but are we always striving? No, we're not always striving to become open-minded, intelligent, and diligent. We're striving to become safe, comfortable, and praised. And once in a while, open-minded, intelligent, and diligent. Yeah, there's a whole lot of shoulds here. Okay, shoulds don't work in syllogisms. Yeah. The person should be empty because I said so. It should be empty because it's a dependent arising. Doesn't matter if it is, it should be. Yeah. Okay, so shoulds don't work very well. Okay, how about this one with, you know, what she did with the Lam Rim. So the polluted aggregates are by nature dukkha because they are under the control of afflictions and polluted karma. Subject, the polluted aggregates, predicate, are by nature dukkha, reason, because they're under the control of afflictions and polluted karma. Property, the polluted aggregates, yeah, are under the control of afflictions and polluted karma. Yeah, that's true. Now, would that be true for somebody who's just coming into Dharma and just starting to learn the Dharma? No, it wouldn't be true for a beginner. They wouldn't be an appropriate person. Yeah. Well, it wouldn't even be true for them. They couldn't see this as true. You know? Yeah?
Even if they can't see it, it's still true for them.
It's true of them, but not for them. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so the polluted aggregates are under the control of afflictions and polluted karma. You know, if you're a beginner, you don't understand that. What about us? Do we understand that?
Apparently not.
But couldn't you say the same for beginners, saying the self is impermanent because it's a product of causes? That also would not be something that they would understand? They have to understand the self. They have to understand product of causes.
Yeah.
Coming into the Dharma, that might not also be.
Right. Right. Because when you come into the Dharma, you need to learn a whole lot of new words, a whole lot of definitions, a whole lot of concepts. Yeah. And, you know, for somebody, you know, by nature dukkha, what does that mean? Yeah. And especially if you translate dukkha as suffering, then that's going to be really hard for them. But even if they have a correct notion of dukkha, you know, look at all the new vocabulary words, a new person, polluted, aggregates, dukkha, afflictions, yeah, polluted karma, nature. I mean, the whole thing is, you know, new vocabulary. Now, what about us? You know, just the property, the polluted aggregates are under the control of afflictions and polluted karma. Do we understand that?
You have to have an incomprehensible realization.
Yeah, our understanding of that is not incontrovertible, is it? Yeah. My aggregates aren't polluted. I'm not under the control of afflictions and karma.
You are.
Yeah. Right, that's right. You are, you know. And that's why you're so mean to me. So straighten up. So yeah. So it's interesting, you know. We can say maybe we have a correct assumption of that. But, you know, incontrovertible understanding. Okay. Now, what about the privation? What would that be? Yeah, if it's under the control of afflictions and polluted karma, it is by nature dukkha. That's true. What kind of understanding of that do we have? Yep, superficial, isn't it? It's something. It's better than, you know, when we didn't know what the words meant. Yeah. Okay. And then what would the counterprivation be? If it's not by nature dukkha, it's necessarily not under the control of afflictions and polluted karma. Okay, for example, what would be something that is not by nature dukkha, because it's and is necessarily not under the control of afflictions of karma. Bodhicitta? Can bodhicitta be under the control of afflictions and polluted karma? If you've generated bodhicitta, have you abolished? No. You can't give bodhicitta as an example. What's something that is not by nature dukkha? Okay, the Dharmakaya. Yeah. It's not by nature dukkha, and it's also necessarily not under the control of afflictions and polluted karma. What's an example of the privation? Something that is under the control of afflictions and polluted karma, and so thus is by nature dukkha. Zopa? Okay. You know, our body, our mind, the person. Okay, and verse 89. Oh, I should have read that verse was violently tossed amidst waves of karma and mental afflictions, plagued by the many sea monsters of the three kinds of sufferings. And please inspire me to develop an intense longing to be free of... you're using a different translation here. Yeah. I seek your blessings to develop an intense longing to be liberated from this infinite and frightening great ocean of existence. Okay, then 89, having considered how all these miserable beings have been my mothers. Who are you talking about? Who's a miserable being? Are you miserable? Yeah. If you're miserable, something's wrong with you. Yeah? No, you are my mother. Okay, having considered how all these miserable beings have been my mothers and raised me with kindness again and again, I seek your blessings. What in the world is a blessing? I seek your inspiration to develop blessing, you know? Are you asking every morning when you say this, you're asking him, the guru, to hit you on the head and give you a blessing? No? Okay. Otherwise, you'd really have an usnisha by now. Okay, please inspire me to develop effortless compassion like that of a loving mother for her precious child. So the syllogism, all sentient beings are lovable because they have raised me with kindness again and again throughout infinite lives. Subject, all sentient beings, predicate, are lovable, reason. Yeah, because they have raised me with kindness again and again throughout infinite lives. So the property? Again, infinite lives. Is that true? We don't really know, do we? You know, have they... raise me with kindness again and again throughout infinite lives?
If someone had ascertained that, they probably already know sentient beings are lovable. That's
true. Yeah. But, you know, that's a difficult reason, isn't it? All sentient beings are lovable, you know? Or all sentient beings have raised me with kindness again and again throughout infinite lives. That's, you know, that's going to be a difficult thing for somebody to understand, isn't it? You need a whole lot of background before you can understand that.
Mm-hmm. Would you only be able to realize that fully as a Buddha when you can recollect all your previous lives? To have an incontrovertible knower of that?
I would think you should. You could probably get it with the super knowledges before that. Although they say, you know, when it comes to previous lives, it's only the Buddha who knows the whole story. Yeah. You can maybe.
I think you have an incontrovertible
inference. Okay. That all sentient beings have raised you with kindness and again and again.
Well, I did a progression.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they all fly, but it was first subject, all sentient beings, predicate, have been my parents, reason because I have taken rebirth in infinite lives. We start with that. Mm-hmm. Then, most of my infinite parents, predicate, have raised me with kindness, reason because they kept me alive from birth until I was self-sufficient. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, Jampel used to always say, how do we know everybody's been our parents? Just because we've had infinite lives, you know, there's also countless sentient beings. Couldn't it be that one of them has missed out on being our parents? You know?
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah?
That's
fair. What about animal parents who eat their kids?
Well, that's why I have most of my infinite parents.
Yeah.
And it's then true. The third one would still have to be my infinite parents are lovable to me because they have raised me with kindness. They're not generically lovable, period.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have to do a lot of
preliminary. Yeah. Yeah. You have to understand certain things and you have to ignore certain things.
Does this imply that the love of a Buddha is conditioned and not unconditional? Because if that statement is true, the love of a Buddha rides on the fact that everybody has been your parent, as opposed to all beings are lovable, period.
Yeah. Okay. This is one of the reasons why they say that this method of generating bodhicitta is not the superior method for generating bodhicitta because it's based too much on how others have treated us as an individual.
What was the original statement?
All sentient beings are lovable because they have raised me with kindness again and again throughout infinite lives.
One, that's to say that all beings are lovable based on faith, which is that all beings raised me with infinite kindness throughout all my lives, which there's nothing wrong with faith, but your condition for love is faith-based in that instance, then it's still condition. It's a condition. Your love is based on a condition in that instance as opposed to unconditional love, which is I love you regardless of anything. To say I love you regardless of anything in this life, because there are infinite lives and there's been many that you have treated me with love and compassion, is still a condition, as opposed to I love you regardless of you having beheaded me in every single one of my previous lives. I still love you from the bottom of my heart.
Yeah. Do you get what he's saying? Yeah.
He said something about the Buddha. I got lost when he talked about
it. No, it's very much a conditional kind of love. Yeah. So it's helpful for training our mind, which needs reasons to see why beings are lovable. But like I said, this is not considered the superior method. The equalizing and exchanging self and others is considered much more profound, you know, for that reason. Because a Buddha wants to, I mean, as a bodhisattva, you want to develop unconditional love. Yeah, like you said, even if you beheaded me in all my previous lives.
I'm thinking that, as you're saying, this is a method for sentient beings. This doesn't imply that the Buddha's love is conditioned the way the statement is conditioned.
Yeah, but the idea is, this is a statement for people trying to train their minds. But it implies that you see somebody lovable because they were kind to you, and why should that change after you go on to become a Buddha? Yeah, I think that's what you're kind of, Okay,
I wonder if you could simplify it by saying all sentient beings are lovable because They and I equally want happiness and want to avoid suffering.
Yeah. Now, does the fact that ourselves and others equally want happiness make other sentient beings lovable? What is a valid reason to prove other sentient beings are lovable?
Well, love is wishing for them to have happiness, and they want happiness.
Yeah. But just because they want it, why should we?
Because they want happiness just like we want happiness. Or yeah. It's equal. I guess yeah. It's moving more towards equalizing self and others.
Yeah. So they are lovable because they and I are equal in wanting happiness. So let's look at that. So what's the property?
All sentient beings are equal in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering.
Okay. So
if beings are equal in wanting happiness, then they're necessarily lovable. Lovable in terms of wishing for them to have happiness, not lovable like romantic love or something.
Right.
The definition of Buddhist love.
Yeah. But when we use lovable, so what you're meaning is like deserving of happiness or worthy of happiness. Let's try that. Sentient beings are worthy of happiness because all of them want happiness equally. So if all of them want happiness equally, are they all worthy of happiness?
I feel like I'm over here thinking that it's almost like lovability can only be proved as an inherent trait based on all sentient beings are lovable because there is no adequate argument against their lovability. Does that make lovability an inherent trait of sentient beings?
That's,
that you can't do anything to negate it?
That's what it's for a bodhisattva. Yeah, that's how you want to see sentient beings. That is an inherent property, you know, not inherently existent. But if it's a sentient being, it's worthy of happiness. It's worthy of being lovable.
So the inherent,
it is lovable.
The inherent nature of lovability is based on causes and conditions of being a sentient being in the first place.
Yeah. No, but just as, you know, a natural quality of sentient beings are, they want happiness and not suffering. Yeah, that's a quality of all sentient beings. And so we're saying that quality alone makes them lovable. I think the word lovable is difficult. Yeah, because like you said, actually in Buddhism, love is the wish for somebody to have happiness. But we hear lovable and we think of having an affectionate feeling towards them, which I think is what bodhisattvas are trying to cultivate. They're not trying to cultivate just a cold feeling of, well, yeah, you're a sentient being, you want happiness, you deserve it. They're trying to cultivate an emotion, you know, a warm-hearted, affectionate emotion. Yeah? Yes, the word lovable is difficult. What is it? Is it referring to that emotion or is it referring just to, you know, cold blank statement of, you know, you're a sentient being, so you should be happy. Okay, let's go down the line here, everybody.
I think the problem with that is the lovability seems like it's being placed in the person, but in a bodhisattva, it's in the bodhisattva's heart, mm-hmm. no matter what the person appears as. And when we say lovable, we're thinking someone appears
yeah.
with a quality.
Right.
But a bodhisattva can look at a horrible monster and see that one as lovable.
Yeah, but when they
so
see,
where's the quality?
But see, they're seeing that lovability in that person.
Right.
Yeah.
So is it there?
Yeah. Well, is there anybody who is a horrible monster?
Not to
through
his
and
or
through.
Her
yeah. And there's yeah, nobody who's a horrible monster in every single thing they've done in their life and in all of their lives.
Right. So no inherent lovability or monstrability.
Well, there's no inherent monstrability. But it seems to be saying that there is some quality of lovability in sentient beings.
Is that their Buddha nature? Part of our Buddha nature?
Yeah, does your the emptiness of your mind make you lovable?
Because you could change.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The subject, the term lovable, is subjective because it is based on the one who finds one lovable and their capacity. Capacity of the person. So lovability is subjective because it's based on the capacity of the person trying to cultivate
to make love. The
love.
Yes.
And yes. So that's what these statements are about, is cultivating love more than they're about the real properties of the object.
Yeah. So the thing is that what we have to see is there's some things that are said in the Dharma that maybe you can't put on the debate ground, but they are used as methods to train the mind because they lead you to develop good qualities. Yeah. But if we go back to lovable meaning, you know, deserving of love because they're a sentient being. Yeah. Now, it would depend what kind of mood we're in when we heard that, wouldn't it?
And which sentient being we're referring to.
Yes, and which sentient being we're referring to. So you see, you know, there's a lot of other knowledge that has to be gained before that's going to be a syllogism that is going to hit somebody. Yeah, because the first thing they're going to say is, you know, why should I consider this guy who slaughtered 17 kids lovable? That's the first thing they're going to say. Yeah. Now, what are you going to say to that? Well, because he was my kind mother in previous lives. Yeah, but look what he's doing this life. He's trying to be happy. Does that make him lovable because he was trying to be happy? Makes him confused. Yeah. Yeah.
If the Buddhist definition of love is the wish for another's happiness and their ultimate happiness at that, which is liberation, then this person that slaughtered your family was not only was he trying to affect happiness, but he was suffering from the same state of existence that you suffer from.
Mm-hmm.
I can object, if I were a bodhisattva, I could objectively say, I wish for his happiness in the same way I wish for all happiness, which is whatever will get us closer to that state of total liberation.
Yeah. You know, if you had a mind with equanimity towards all living beings, if you had a mind where your opinion factory had been bombed out and forever destroyed, then that would work. Yeah.
Oh, that's how I felt in my original saying of all beings are lovable and have this trait of lovability because it's the most worthwhile thing to wish their happiness, whether it be temporal or ultimate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Adding to his point, I think can't we do every sentient beings is lovable to bodhisattvas? Then we kind of solve all that.
you know, the discussions that we're having.
Yeah, that's the thing, that to a bodhisattva, you know, everybody appears lovable. Although I was talking with one Geshe once, and he was saying, well, a bodhisattva would still see somebody as an enemy, but they just would not be angry towards that person, but they would still see them as an enemy. And I wasn't so sure I agreed, you know, because I would think a bodhisattva might say, okay, this person's doing this behavior that's contrary to what I'm trying to do. Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily make him an enemy. It makes him more a suffering sentient being.
I was thinking about this fellow that killed those 17 people. Now there's going to be people that are interacting with him. And, you know, how are you going to interact with someone like that? If you interact with hate and disdain, you're not going to get anything anywhere. If you act with some loving kindness and some openness, then that sets the stage for some change, some growth, some understanding.
Yeah. Okay, should we go on to the next one? So here's the verse. Others and I are no different. No one wishes even the slightest suffering or is ever content with the happiness they have. Inspire me to find joy in giving happiness to others. So, shall I read the first? This one's an erroneous syllogism. The subject, I, should take joy in the happiness of others because we are all equal in wanting happiness and freedom from suffering. Yeah, I think, you know, what with these things, I always ask, what is the thing I'm trying to learn something about? And what is it I'm trying to learn? Yeah. So from this verse, others and I are no different. No one wishes even the slightest suffering or is ever content with the happiness they have. Inspire me to find joy in giving happiness to others. Is there just one syllogism in here, or are there a few? Okay, others and I are no different because no one wishes even the slightest suffering or is ever content with the happiness they have. That's one syllogism. Yeah, is that a valid syllogism? Subject? Others and I, predicate. Are no different. Reason?
Because none of us wishes even the slightest suffering or is ever content with the happiness we have.
Right. So the property of the subject, others and I, are never wish for even the slightest suffering or is ever content with the happiness we have. Okay, then the pervasion. What's the pervasion?
None of us wish for even the slightest of sufferings or is ever content with the happiness we have. And there's no difference between this and necessarily there's no difference between
ourselves. No, it's necessarily no different. If no one wishes even the slightest suffering or is ever content with the happiness they have, if it's somebody, we would have to say, if it's somebody who wishes, who never wishes even the slightest suffering or is ever content with the happiness they have, they are necessarily no different. Yeah, there's something, we have to get two people in here if we're going to talk about difference. Yeah? So maybe we have to reword the reason to be others and I. Neither others or I wish for the slightest suffering or is ever content for the happiness we have. So if neither others or I never wish for even the slightest suffering or ever content with the happiness we have, then we are necessarily no different. But we're different people and we have different hair color.
You have different strategies of
that. Yeah. So something, it needs more qualification, doesn't it? I and others are no different in what particular way?
is the Buddha nature.
Huh?
We have a Buddha nature.
And that we have, but it doesn't say anything about Buddha nature in the syllogism. So you would have to say others and I are no different in terms of wanting happiness and not suffering, because no one wishes even the slightest suffering is ever content with the happiness they have. But that's kind of the second and the predicate and the reason saying the same thing. So that doesn't make a good syllogism.
Can we do because, oh, we are both sentient beings?
Because what?
Because we are both sentient beings.
Because we're both sentient beings. Others and I are no different because we're both sentient beings.
Others and I are no different in terms of wanting for happiness and not wanting for suffering because we're both sentient beings.
Okay. Others.
Because we're both humans or.
Yeah, we're both. So others and I are no different in terms of wanting happiness and not suffering because we are both sentient beings. Okay. So does the property hold? Others and I are both sentient beings. That's good. What's the pervasion? If you are sentient beings, you are necessarily no different in terms of not wanting wanting suffering and not wanting happiness. That true? That sounds pretty okay. So say the syllogism again. Now that we figured out it was right, what was it again? Okay, so others and I are no different in terms of not wanting suffering and wanting happiness because we are both sentient beings. So that would work, yeah. And that would be a good one to spend some time meditating on, you know. Just the fact of being human beings means that we're no different. But then we need to get from, okay, we're no different in wanting happiness and wanting suffering, to get from that to lovability or worthwhile of having happiness and not suffering. Yeah, and for that, you really need a mind that's impartial, because any kind of partiality is going to kill that one. You won't understand it. We got to do some reading today, so this will be the last thing.
So my comment is that it kind of goes on what you said before. Some things that we use for mind training are not suitable for syllogisms. And the quality of loving or not loving, as Jazz and the Losong said, is the quality of the lover, not anything about the object of the love. Mm-hmm. And so for us to reason our way, we have to really talk about the person who is the lover and what is the logic that makes you a lover of beings equally.
Yeah.
Not anything about your object.
I think it does have to do with the object. I think you have to be able to transform that object into something that's pleasing, I should
say.
That's
still your mind. Your mind, that is a quality of your mind.
Yeah.
Not that object. That object has no inherent meaning one way or the other, so you can't make any statements about the inherent nature of that being lovable. It has to be from your mind.
Now, I think it has, I agree with you, it has mostly to do with our mind, but we have to see that quality in somebody. Yes. Yeah? Which means they have to have that quality to some extent. Otherwise, we have a wrong consciousness.
So for me, getting my little tiny thing out there is thinking about the wonderfulness of sentience in and of itself. Why a sentient being is not a rock, and mm-hmm. how I will never become enlightened by having a relationship with a rock.
So that depends on some quality of the sentient being, doesn't it? Because if it had nothing to do with the object, then you could love a rock.
It's just the sentience in and of itself. The sentience, nothing about how that sentience is one way or another. Going back to what Jess says, whether that sentience led it to cut my head off or be my loving mother, no matter. The sentience in and of itself has value that's not in the rock.
But I think the value is that it's somebody that wants happiness and not suffering. That's the quality that, you know, is the basic thing about a sentient being.
And has the potential to have that happiness.
Yeah. Okay, this is going to be the last comment because we need to do some.
Is someone with the emotional centers of their brain surgically removed not deemed worthy of love because they cannot feel happiness, because they have no want for happiness, because they don't care about suffering? They are still an autonomous being and capable of their own decisions and actions, but there's no basis for happiness within them whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. I don't think the wish for having happiness and not suffering has to be there at that particular time. So it could be somebody in a coma. Yeah. But simply because at some time in their continuum there has been that wish. Okay. We were with Unpacking the Buddhist Enthymeme. Is that where we were? Okay. So there's a lot of stuff we'll go through, but we can also go quickly because there's a lot of repetition coming up. But the repetition is useful. As described in this, an enthymeme, I looked it up. Do you know what it means? It means an argument in which one of the statements is not explicitly said. Okay. So, as described in this chapter, it is easy to understand that the single-sentence syllogism used in the collective tactics tradition of Buddhist reasoning implies the more familiar syllogistic form consisting of a series of sentences leading to a conclusion. That is his opinion. I don't agree with that. You know, he's speaking to people who are Western philosophers who are more familiar with the series of sentences. I started out just learning syllogisms, and they're fine with me. They don't seem strange and unfamiliar, but he's addressing an audience to which they are strange and unfamiliar. Okay. For instance, the sample syllogism, the subject sound is an impermanent phenomenon because of being a product, implies a series of three sentences and a conclusion. Okay, don't look at the book. What are the three sentences that are being implied? They're the three criteria, aren't they? They're the three criteria. Okay, so in this syllogism, what are they? Sound is a product. Whatever is a product is necessarily impermanent. And whatever is not impermanent is necessarily not a product. And the conclusion? Therefore, sound is a product. Okay? Sound is impermanent. Yeah. Okay. So normally the major premise, which is reckoned, so this is Western philosophy terminology, which is reckoned between the reason and the predicate of the thesis or conclusion is put first. So the major premise is basically the privation. And the minor premise, which is reckoned between the subject and the reason, is put second. So that's the property of the subject. However, here in Buddhist philosophy, they are stated in the order of the three modes of the sign. So first the property, then the privation, then the counter-privation. In the Buddhist enthymeme, the minor premise that sound is a product and the thesis conclusion, that sound is an impermanent phenomena are stated explicitly. the major premise that all products are impermanent, and the Buddhist enthymeme, the minor premise that sound is a product, so the property, and the thesis conclusion that sound is an impermanent phenomena, in other words, the conclusion, are stated explicitly. The major premise, which is the forward provision, that all products are impermanent phenomena, is suppressed or merely implied and not stated explicitly. Okay. The first three sentences in this implied syllogism are premises only in the sense that if they are true, then the conclusion too must be true. For any valid syllogism, the implied premises are not just assumptions that may or may not be true. Okay, this is helping us. Rather, according to the way the three modes of the sign are defined in this system of reasoning, the three sentences implied by any valid argument must be true, and a person for whom the argument is valid must ascertain them as true. Okay, so they're not assumptions. They're not probabilities, they're not shoulds, they're not ifs. Yeah. Okay, then the following questions pertain to the standard sample syllogism. Yeah. Okay, so then there's a thing to work with your debate partner. Yeah, so I will leave it to you to do this in the next week. Okay. Do you all have a debate partner? If you don't, get one. Ask somebody to dance. You can write notes back and forth. You point to the question, what is the subject in the sample syllogism? Then somebody has to, yeah. Okay. So that's the first exercise. So do that with your partner or just do it yourself, yeah? Then two, there is some quality about this form of argument that doesn't quite fit in at first. Do you feel that way? I mean, this is him. Yeah, perhaps it is backward to the way we normally reason. I don't find it backwards. Yeah, it's new. Does anybody find it backwards? To how you normally think? Or how you normally reason? Okay. It's clearer than I normally think. Yeah, it's clearer, isn't it? Okay, so exercise 6.2. Let's go on to 6.3. Forge your own syllogisms. Okay, so choose one from column A, subjects, one from column B, predicates to be proven, and one from column C, reasons, to make a logically sound argument. Try to make at least 20. So I think this is a good exercise to do because we've been making our own syllogisms, but, you know, and through doing so, we've learned a lot about what doesn't work in making a syllogism. But I think doing this exercise may show us what does work. Okay, so you want to try it? Okay, somebody look at the chart and pick one from A, B, and C and make it into a syllogism, and then we'll test it out. Okay, the subject cat is inexistent because of being an impermanent phenomena. Okay, subject cat, predicate is inexistent. Reason? Because it's impermanent. Property of the subject? Cat is impermanent phenomena. Forward pervasion? If it's an impermanent phenomena, it's necessarily existent. Counter pervasion? If it's not existent, it's necessarily not impermanent. Yeah, if it's not existent, it's necessarily not an impermanent phenomenon. No, for the counter pervasion, it's the negative of the predicate is necessarily not the negative of the reason. Okay? Mm-hmm. So you got to remember that.
So it's not B, it's not C.
Yeah. It's not B, it's not C. Okay. Somebody else pick some arguments out of the, make one out of the chart.
Sound is a product because of being an impermanent phenomenon.
No. Oh, okay. Because of being an impermanent phenomenon. Okay. Let's make another one, okay?
Okay.
Just make anyone.
A chair is a product. Well, no, that's the same thing. So a cat is an existent. Oh, we already did that. A chair is an impermanent phenomenon because of being a product.
It's just the other way around.
Yeah. We just
did that too.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to make something illogical. A red car is a non-existent because of being a product. I mean, it's totally logical.
Okay, yeah. So a red car is a non-existent. What did you say? Yeah, red car is a non-existent because of being a product. Okay. Yeah, why doesn't this one work? What's wrong with it? Which part doesn't work? Of the three criteria, which part? No, of the three criteria. The forward pervasion doesn't work. Yeah? Why not?
A product is not a non-existent.
Yeah, because if it's a product,
it's not necessarily
a non-existent. Okay? People see that? If it's a product, yeah, the forward privation should be, if it's a product, it's necessarily a non-existent. Is that true? No. So if it's a product, it's not necessarily a non-existent. Okay, how about a red car is a mammal because it's a reptile? Okay, what's wrong with that one? Okay, one person at a time. Tell what's wrong with it. The reason's not established. So, what are you saying?
A reptile is not a red car, and a red car is not a reptile.
Okay, so So, is that what reason not established mean? That the property doesn't work? Okay. So the reason's not established because the car isn't a reptile. Okay, what else? Why else doesn't that one work? No probation. Why?
Reptile is not necessarily a mammal.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so I think we done that. Okay, then the freestyle exercise, create at least 10 of your own syllogisms in the Buddhist form. We've been doing that. Okay. So, do you want to make up some more that make sense, that are easy? The students are silent because they are uninterested, falling asleep, bored, stupid, thinking.
So all living beings in the six realms are approaching death moment by moment because living beings are impermanent phenomena subject to aging, sickness, and death.
Make it simpler.
All living beings in the six realms are approaching death because they are subject to aging, sickness, and death.
Yeah. Are the beings in the God realm subject to sickness? Well, they kind of get sick.
They start smelling.
But in the form and formless realm, you have to take. Yeah.
No, you can't. Okay.
You can't. You can't get old either.
All living beings in the desire realm.
In the desire realm, okay.
Are approaching death because they are subject to aging, sickness, and death.
Okay. So, somebody, we have everybody talking at once. How about we just go down the line? And so what's the property?
All living beings are subject.
That all subject to aging, sickness, and death is the reason. All living beings in the desire realm are subject to aging, sickness, and death. Okay. Then what's the forward provision?
Anything that is approach... What? I've lost it. Anything that is subject to sickness, aging, and death is necessarily moving towards death.
Some bordering on that line of the second and third one being the same thing. Yeah, they're a little bit different. One is subject to, the other is moving towards. But, yeah. Make it so, Venerable Sim, can you make the syllogism a little bit different so that we don't run into that problem? All sentient beings in the desire realm are approaching death because?
They are... Because they are under the influence of ignorance, karma, and delusions.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so all sentient beings in the desire realm are approaching death because they're under the influence
of ignorance karma, and delusion.
Delusion or affliction, yeah. Okay, Venerable Pende, you don't agree? What's wrong with it? Okay, check. Start out checking the property. What would the property be? All living beings in the desire realm. Yeah. All living beings in the desire realm are under the influence of ignorance. Yeah. Ignorance, afflictions, and karma. Okay, that's good. So is that true? Yeah. Okay. Then what's the privation?
If someone is under the influence of affliction, ignorance, afflictions, and they're necessarily moving towards death.
Yeah, it's necessarily somebody moving.
It's not true.
Hmm? If somebody is under the influence of ignorance, afflictions, and karma, they are necessarily approaching death.
Yeah, I don't see the connection. If I was a Buddhist, I see it, but if I wasn't a Buddhist, I wouldn't see that connection.
Right, but if you are a Buddhist.
Well, even still, they seem kind of stretched.
Well, think about what does it mean to be under the influence of ignorance, afflictions, and karma?
It seems like the two things you're comparing there, you're supposed to have like a relationship and they seem a little too far apart to my mind.
I would suggest do some more meditation.
I understand it, but in terms of writing a syllogism, I mean, I understand the ideas, that isn't the problem. It's formulating something that where they have a more of a direct relationship to me.
Do other people feel it's not a direct relationship, or do you think it's a direct relationship? People may have different feelings. Yeah?
I just wanted to ask, if you said samsara, would that make it work instead of the other?
Under the influence of ignorance. So you would say you would change the syllogism to everybody. All the beings in the desire realm are moving towards death because they're in samsara. You would change it that way. Yeah.
Shakyamuni Buddha died too. So enlightened beings can also die, right? So in that case, it doesn't hold.
But are they? I think we're talking about ordinary beings in the desire realm. Yeah, we said living, all living beings. We should probably say all ordinary living beings. Although I don't know, you would say, I don't think you would say the Buddha is in the desire realm. No. Yeah. Yeah. And you would say bodhisattvas are manifesting in the desire realm.
So someone online proposed another syllogism: all desire realm beings are approaching death simply because they were born.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that one. Yeah. That one works well. Mm-hmm.
The previous one, though, the pervasion holds.
Yeah, the pervasion holds.
And so you might not see the connection, but obviously everything that's under the influence of karma and polluted karma and afflictions is approaching death.
Is approaching
and
death,
so
right.
It works.
Yeah,
it does work.
It's a valid syllogism. And that's why I was suggesting doing more meditation on the meaning of what being under the influence of afflictions and karma actually means, you know, that might help to make that connection. Yeah. And what now seems far apart, that you know, if you do more reflection, it might help it become closer in your mind.
Thank you. That's very good advice.
Okay. I think we have to stop now.
Someone had raised this question earlier,
okay,
when we were talking about the school shooting.
Uh-huh.
So she wants to know what happens to a person in the moment of a quick death. What do they experience?
As I've been taught, the elements dissolve very, very quickly. You go through all the eight steps exceedingly quickly and into the bardo quickly. Yeah, and so what your last thought is going to have a lot of importance. But, you know, it's hard to know in the school shootings what the kid's last thought would even be, because some of them, didn't even know what was going on. Yeah.